You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We just heard from a Palestinian-American doctor from Stockton who returned from a humanitarian mission offering emergency medical aid to Gaza. According to the Associated Press, since Hamas launched an attack on Israelis on October 7th, the health ministry in Gaza reports at least 31,000 Palestinians have been killed and that women and children make up two-thirds of the dead. And that death toll is deeply felt here by Palestinian Americans, many of whom have lost loved ones in Gaza. That devastating reality is one that is being discussed at length in Sacramento. Leila El-Haddad is a Palestinian writer and author from Gaza. Leila spent time in Sacramento this past Thursday at Sac City College discussing the ongoing crisis and sharing how she uses food to humanize the stories of Palestinians and to keep the memories of family members killed in the conflict alive. Leila joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, of course. Thank you for taking the time. And I hope you got back home safe after being here in Sacramento last week. Can you briefly introduce yourself to listeners? You have a very lengthy career as a writer, as an author, and also as a journalist.
I'm, as you said, a Palestinian writer, an author. I'm based in Maryland. I also spent many years in Gaza, where my family all resides and where I spent a lot of my childhood and all of my summers, and co-author of a book called The Gaza Kitchen, A Palestinian Culinary Journey. That's a sort of ethnographic approach to, it's a cookbook, first and foremost, about the Palestinian cuisine of Gaza, but also uses a kind of ethnographic approach to exploring, using the food of lens to explore the situation in Gaza, that we published many years ago, but it's still as relevant as ever, given the current situation.
Yeah, I follow you on Instagram, and your handle is Gaza Mom. And I was looking at a post that you had from last month about hosting a benefit dinner and using food as a way to raise awareness for what is unfolding and continuing to unfold in Gaza. What has food and cuisine and the culture behind it, how has that led to really a tool to educate others and to raise awareness during this time?
Yeah, I mean, maybe I'll backtrack. You know, when we first wrote the book, my co-author and I, even then it was with great difficulty that we were able to get to Gaza. Even myself as a Palestinian with a Gaza ID and paperwork and family, but even then it was difficult. And we intuited that this was something that was necessary, something, a piece of work like this, not only to as a tool of education, but really as a means to be able to document the cuisine that we felt was also itself under siege and under fire, and be able to provide it for other Palestinians who were, you know, either forcibly removed from their homeland or dispossessed of it and of their heritage. But also, as you said, as a means indeed to, through this lens of food, to educate others about the situation. And our intuition was correct then, and even years later, you know, not that we want it to be correct. Unfortunately, Gaza is yet again, you know, facing an even more brutal onslaught and genocide. And there's been renewed interest in the book and in understanding, I think, for a lot of people. Gaza is this, you know, abstraction that's really difficult to understand, that only conjures up images of destruction and destitution and bombardment. And while that is certainly part of the story, and especially now, there's also this whole other side of it, right? It has a very rich history. It was always the nexus between civilizations and the crossroads of all the different spice routes, and had a prosperous hub along the Mediterranean. It's very difficult to think of Gaza in that way, but it's more commonly historically known as a place that was rich and known for its hospitality and you know, cited often by different traders that would pass through. So I often find that audiences, and even journalists, I had a, you know, an interesting conversation with a journalist for CBS, who don't or can't otherwise, or even won't otherwise, want to know about Gaza are able to do so through this medium. Because it's also, everything is interconnected. It's not, you know, food tells a larger story, as we know. And in the case of Gaza in particular, what we see now is, and what we have seen, it's been an extension of a longstanding policy, but in a much more brazen and sort of pernicious manner now, is the deliberate targeting of Gaza's foodways and control over those foodways as well. So Oxfam and, you know, the World Food Organization and others have noted that Israel has systematically been targeting, it started off by targeting the farms, the agricultural assets, you know, the irrigation, and this extends, of course, to the sea. And again, this is part of a longstanding 17-year-long policy under the Israeli blockade of Gaza, where it has severely restricted and controlled and destroyed the food system. And so while we weave, you know, I weave in, obviously, and as you said, I had a benefit in which we like to highlight and showcase the food, traditional foods of Gaza, because I feel like that in and of itself is important in humanizing, rehumanizing, unfortunately, Palestinians, since dehumanization has been very much a part of the policy of the attack on Gaza. It's also an introduction for people to the region and to be able to then begin this more difficult and uncomfortable conversation about all the things that I just mentioned about the genocide, the attack on the foodways, the deliberate starvation and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, as I'm learning from you, I mean, food is powerful. It's more than just food. It can really open minds. And I would just think, obviously, it's even more poignant that we're having this conversation now in light of everything that's unfolding. You also said you have family members in Gaza. Have you been able to keep in touch with them? Do you know how they're doing?
Yes, I have several dozen family members throughout the Gaza Strip. Several of them have been displaced multiple times or in the south, but about the majority are in the north, in Gaza City. We have intermittent communication, so more so with those in the south that are often able to update us on those in the north. And that's important. We try our best to stay in touch. I think it's also important for them to feel that we are thinking of them, that we are doing for them, that they are not abandoned and they are not alone, which they often express is kind of their biggest fear, that people will just forget about them. But the situation is dire, as your previous guest noted, and others who have recently been there have also noted, most notably Palestinian writer Susan Abulhawa, who had just come back and said it's far worse than you know, anyone can imagine. And despite that, they try to keep, you know, in best spirits as they can, but they have been without power now for months. You know, it's almost become, you know, the abnormal has, unfortunately, and we shouldn't make it, we shouldn't normalize it, but they've been without any electricity for all these months now, as, you know, Israeli officials said they would cut off the power, and they did, and not allow fuel in, and they have done just that. So they've been cooking largely with whatever they can find, pieces of wood, charcoal. They've had to kind of create these, you know, small ovens out of old, you know, tin cans, or make clay ovens. Not everyone has that kind of knowledge. I mean, at least my family members mostly were professionals who were teaching, you know, universities and bankers and pharmacists and so forth. So, but that's what they've had to resort to doing to survive. And it's especially difficult for my cousins in the north of Gaza, who have not had steady or regular access to clean water or to any kind of, you know, animal protein or fruits or vegetables. They've largely been relying on things like animal feed to bake bread with, or whatever canned foods they can get their hand on, or beans or lentils. So it's very harrowing. And yet my cousin told me, she sent me a picture of a group of people on her street in Gaza City who had put up a very large decorative lantern in the street just to try to, you know, celebrate, to feel, to sort of break this, you know, this violence that has been leashed upon them. to celebrate Ramadan with, of course, lanterns being a fixture of the month. And I heard the call to prayer in the background, and she told me, you know, don't be fooled. That's not an actual, usually call to, Muslim call to prayers are made 5 times a day live by a muadzin from the mosque. And she said that's just a recording that people are amplifying on their phones because, again, there's no operational mosques. More than 1,000 mosques have been destroyed, fully or partially. And so she said people are just playing the call to prayer just so, you know, we can hear it and we can feel that there is some kind of routine or normality, and people were praying out on the streets instead of the mosques for their daily prayers.
I mean, I think about, you know, your loved ones in Gaza, and I also think about you professionally as an author, also a journalist. You were formerly a Gaza correspondent. You're a regular contributor on BBC World News. I mean, are you able to compartmentalize all of this? I mean, there's obviously a very deep personal connection, but then you also have this perseverance and this mission to talk and to hold events like you were just in Sacramento last week to talk about Gaza, rehumanizing Gazans, as you say.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I don't have a choice, but I absolutely have to sometimes compartmentalize. But, you know, there's moments that are really difficult when I testified in the federal court in Oakland in January for the lawsuit that I and others were filing against the Biden administration for their complicity in genocide. And that was really difficult, you know, having to relay what my family members were going through, speaking about my aunt and my cousins who were killed in an Israeli airstrike in their home in November. And sometimes I do have to kind of separate my worlds, but I think it's also important to use our voices as Palestinians to narrate our own experiences, kind of echoing the late Edward Said in his seminal essay, Permission to Narrate. I think that's what's been missing largely from the coverage. And I feel as an American and as a Palestinian and as a human being, frankly, with family in Gaza specifically, it's my, and as a taxpayer, it's, you know, I'm obligated to speak out and to, you know, muster up whatever energy I have in the most effective way. And I recognize that not everyone can do that, to speak out on their behalf, to advocate on their behalf, to organize in you know, whatever, with whatever tools and knowledge that I have. And I think that's something that they have mandated me with, my family members, and they keep saying that's so important and we really want you to keep doing this. And so so I do it. You know, there's no alternative. The alternative is to, you know, silence his complicity, to sit by. And also, frankly, it's somewhat cathartic because we're just overwhelmed with sadness and anger, and it can eat you alive. So you have to just convert that into something that you feel is making a difference. And it's not easy because you sit here and you see, you know, you see the numbers, and it's like unlike anything we've seen in recent history. It's the fastest occurring genocide in recent history, according to humanitarian organizations. And you see that close to 50,000 Palestinians have been killed, including those who have bodies have not been retrieved. And you see that you know that your government can stop it, that President Biden can stop it with a single phone call, and is deliberately choosing not to. And I think that's what makes it all so difficult.
In the last few minutes that we have, you know, when you were here in Sacramento, tell us about the events that you were part of and what the focus of your conversations were.
I was speaking to students in the afternoon and to a community in the evening, and it ran the gamut from speaking about what my family members are enduring, you know, what I've been up to in terms of organizing, as I said, the lawsuit that we filed against the Biden administration and the appeal to that's been ongoing, and why that's significant and important as well, as well as, you know, about recent work I've done writing in terms of a piece I had in Savour magazine talking about my late aunt and, you know, the culinary legacy with which she left me. So, yeah, it was just a broader conversation as well about the history of Gaza. And again, it's just keeping those conversations going. I try to reach new audiences. I was especially impressed with the how invested the students were. And they were great listeners and had really, I think, very insightful questions. And I really appreciate that, because that means that people are, you know, taking note, they're listening, they're learning. And that's always, to me, the first step, is, you know, educating and informing others and learning yourself about a situation in which we, you know, as Americans are directly complicit.
Hmm. You mentioned the lawsuit that you are part of, and it's currently in the appeals process. A federal judge in Oakland dismissed the lawsuit last month. It's now moving forward in the process. What would you like people to know about this lawsuit? Because we did have Bassem El-Khara on. He leads CARE's efforts here in the Sacramento Valley. He testified along with you for this lawsuit, and CARE is the Council on American-Islamic Relations. He focuses here on Sacramento. What do you want people to know about this lawsuit as it continues to make its way through the legal process?
Well, it sounds like, you know, Bassem did a great job of summarizing, but essentially it was, we were suing President Biden and Secretary of State Blinken and Secretary of Defense Austin for their failure to prevent an ongoing genocide, which is, of course, illegal under the Geneva Convention, to which the U.S. is a signatory, and for providing, for their complicity in that genocide by providing financial and diplomatic and military cover. And what was really significant about it, because often people might say, you know, what are the limits to, you know, the courts or the limits of the law, what's the point? And I think it was really significant. It came at a moment in time when a lot of us we still are, but really completely broken. As Palestinian Americans with family in Gaza, feeling like no matter what we were doing or saying, not only was not being heard, but our voices and our families, you know, deaths were actively being erased, invisibilized, as the Biden administration, you know, even cast that into question, their deaths into question, and failed to mention them even on the 100th day of the genocide. So having that space in which we could share our stories, share their stories, have lengthy discussion of, you know, not just what's happening now, but the history of Palestinian dispossession and the Palestinian Nakba of 1948, or the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians, and how that pertains to today, to what we're seeing now. Providing that context and having that on the court record was incredibly powerful. And it's of significance that President Biden is the only sitting president now having been accused of a plausible genocide. And I think that, if nothing, it continues to add pressure, and as we've seen, to shift the course of this administration's policy on Gaza and hopefully, you know, in the right direction to put an end to this genocide and unwavering and flagging U.S. support for Israel. The appeals will continue to accomplish.
Thank you so much, Leila, for joining us and taking the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Leila El-Haddad is a Palestinian author and writer from Gaza, and she was in Sacramento last week talking about the ongoing crisis and also the connections between food, politics, and cultural preservation. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.